Hi everyone, I'm here with the paranormalist Patty Wilson. Patty, how are you tonight?
I'm doing really good today. Weather's been a little better, even if it has been wet. It's a little warmer. I'm thrilled with that. Ready to tell stories tonight.
Maybe for you, but it was colder here for us. Yeah.
And we've got yesterday was 58 degrees, or no, 62 degrees. Today was 40 something, but that's not bad for heading out of the end of January.
Yeah, Mrs. Stu and I had to head out today to do a little bit of marketing because she had to work yesterday. So this is Sunday when we're recording this. So this will release on Groundhog Day, Friday, February 2nd, which also happens to be Mr. and Mrs. Stu's 36th wedding anniversary. So we'll be...
Oh, my.
If I don't put the notice on Facebook like I normally do, We'll still have the episodes on Rumble and YouTube and Facebook. Rumble, YouTube, and audio platforms like Spotify and that things. Those will be automatically, provided that I get to edit everything this week. So,
yeah.
And besides that, I would like to personally thank all of the listeners who have graciously supported us by contributing to the Buy Me a Coffee. We really do appreciate that to help to further the podcast. And I'd like to personally thank Sharon and Kate for contributing. We really do appreciate it.
Yes, thank you very much. And we appreciate all the help you've given us.
Please consider clicking the like or subscribe button that's down below. And you also find in the description of this video everything related to the Paranormalist podcast, the Facebook groups, email address, and all of the associated other things with it, including Patty's books on Amazon. So thank you, and here we go with the episode. All right, so without further ado, what is our topic for this evening?
So I was looking at like the Bermuda Triangle and things of that nature, and I have long been fascinated with the Bennington Triangle, and in the end, I ended up going with the Bennington Triangle. So it's in Vermont.
Okay.
It's one of the lesser known, but it has a bizarre history that goes way back, like before whites even entered the area, kind of way back. So I just wanted to tell a little history to kind of get everybody settled on and up to speed on it. So in 1791, there were six families that moved into a place called Glastonbury, which is a little town in, it was purchased by the governor of New Hampshire, and he named it for Glastonbury in England. Now, they lived on this mountain, and there really wasn't a whole lot of commerce or anything until they realized that the lumber itself was their commodity. So they could not only use the lumber, but they made charcoal, which was heavily in demand at the time. And because it was such a very isolated spot, I believe it, like at the apex of its existence, there was only like 400 and some people in the whole area. So we're talking a very rural spot. And this became their only claim to fame. There was a railroad that was put in to help in the 1800s to kind of help move everything along. But whenever the wood died out, when there was nothing literally left to harvest except for saplings, they basically had deforested the entire mountainside. Wow. And I mean, if you can think about, like, this is a huge mountain range and they deforested the entire mountain.
When you said 1791, nobody's got chainsaws. Yeah.
No, that's a lot of hard work. And like I said, it was like an over 100 years of, of working to get to that point. But they didn't understand conserving. They didn't understand like replanting. Today, when somebody cuts trees, they usually plant three for one. I have a family that works in the lumber industry, and that's the rule, 3 to 1. You take one tree, you plant three saplings, and hopefully at least one or two of them will take off. And so they basically worked themselves out of a job. So now, they're sitting there, they've got no work. The town begins to die out because people are moving to other places where there's more prosperity. And Then they came up with this great idea. Hey, there's this train, which is actually one of the steepest train tracks in the world at the time. And because you're going literally up a mountain, and we have this transportation, why don't we redo the town and make it into this amazing place so that you could use it as B&Bs and market it in some way? And a lot of money went into that. They marketed the town. They actually had electric train cars. Like people think, I think it's fascinating that people are like, oh, electric vehicles, you know, that's just so amazing and innovative. And in 100 years, dude, do you know the first electric car was in the 1800s and it didn't work? I mean, it worked short term, but it didn't work long term. They bumped into the same things they're bumping into now. Like, how do you charge it whenever it's really, really cold and that kind of stuff? They had electric train cars. So this was like the shining city on a hill with electric train cars and all of these, you know, gadgets and gadgets. And through the summer, they made a great showing. They had these amazingly beautiful buildings that had been built and you know, all this construction had gone on, and they put these beautiful shops and stores and what have you in, and all these beautiful places for you to hike and what have you. And it was a success. And then in the fall, the rains came. And what happens when you have a deforested mountainside and a lot of rain? Mudslides and flooding. And the town got wiped out. And there was nobody willing to put that kind of money back into it, because obviously the next year and the year after that and the year after that, until nature reclaimed everything, it was going to be a horrible mess. And you couldn't recoup enough in the summertime to make up for it, because frankly, it was way too isolated, way too cold. And, you know, that mountain was just kind of dangerous in the winter, so that you only had spring, summer, and possibly fall.
Which is amazing that the train would still go through there. If it had that steep of a track, you'd think that the footing of the track would be in danger as well.
Yeah, well, and it wiped out, I mean, whenever the flood hit, it wiped everything out.
Okay. Oh,
but
okay.
Yeah, no. So when the flood hit, it took everything. And, you know, and like any other place where there had been a lot of, you know, lumbermen and what have you, the place had a little bit of a reputation. So, you know, the locals were kind of, because there had been a couple murders in 1892. There was a murder from a mill worker named Henry McDowell, who they don't know why, but he went crazy. Like, he was a nice guy. He was a normal average dude. And then one day he went nuts and he murdered another worker, John Crowley, by bashing him in the head with either wood or a rock, depending on who tells you the tale. Then he ran away to Norwalk, Connecticut. And there I don't understand this. He ran away and then he went to the police and confessed, which makes no sense to me.
Well, I've had enough of running. I'm going to turn myself in.
Maybe they'll give me a better shot at it, because they didn't know this dude, you know, whatever it was. And when he finally confessed, he told them this bizarre story about how there were babbling voices in his head that wouldn't let him alone, and that this is why he killed John Crowley. And eventually, it was decided that the humane thing to do under the circumstances was to put him in the state mental asylum. And that's where he ended up. But old Henry wasn't done yet, because Henry escapes. He hid in a railroad car, carrying a load of coal in to the asylum, and took Henry out. There are people who claimed at the time that he went back to Glastonbury area, and that he ended up living in the wilderness out there for the rest of his life. That will come back to visit us later, so make sure you take note of that one, guys, because he is a possible protagonist for something that'll happen down the road.
Noted.
And then there was another fella in 1897. His name was John Harbor. He was respected. He was living in another little village called Woodford. And he went out near Glastonbury. He was hunting with his brother and a family friend, and they, you know, they split up into separate areas to see if they could flush anything out. And all of a sudden, the brother and the friend said they heard a rifle go off. Their first thought was he got something. And then they heard him screaming, "I've been shot. I've been shot." They ran in his direction and hunted him, but they couldn't find him. It was about 11 o'clock the next morning before he was found. He had crawled under a cedar tree, which had like really low hanging branches. And eventually somebody noticed his feet sticking out. Something about the story didn't make any sense. The first thing they thought is that somebody else shot him. Then they thought maybe he shot himself. But when they found him up under the tree, he was sitting like up in the branches, like leaning into the branches, which would, to anybody's way of thinking, be extremely uncomfortable. And so he was kind of wedged up, sitting up in the branches at the bottom of the tree, and his feet are sticking out from underneath it. His gun is still loaded and it's sitting very neatly beside him, as if somebody had placed it there. Now, they had found the spot where he had been shot because there was blood there. It was quite a ways from there to this spot, and there was no trail, meaning there was no like crawling in the debris, you know, somebody stumbling along, fall. There was no blood, there was no broken branches, there was nothing you would look for. So they couldn't figure out how he got there unless somebody else put him there. And that somebody else had to be pretty strong to pick up a full adult male and carry him effortlessly into that area and then tuck him up under into those trees, into that tree.
Without leaving any trail behind either.
Yeah, because like, you know, you could pick something heavy up, but you would see heavier indentations and like places where your foot slipped and in the dirt and stuff like that. There would have been something, or even if it was just in the leaf litter, there would have been something. He had been moved, but by who, by what, they weren't sure. They never really do find out. After this, like I said, the area kind of got a little bad reputation, you know, except between the loggers, because loggers can be kind of rough people. People began to talk about the fact that the very first whites who came to the area had been warned by the Native Americans that lived there, which were the Abenaki, that this area, this mountain was sacred, that you shouldn't go there, that it was... and I don't mean sacred as in venerated. I mean sacred as in they were afraid of it, and that there were spirits on it and you needed to let them alone. They talked about what sounded, I'm sure, crazy to the first people who came there, because when I tell you this, it's going to sound crazy to you too. They talked about the fact that there was the man-eating rock on that mountain, and that if you stepped on this rock, their story was that if you stepped on this rock, it would swallow you whole. And that they had lost members of their tribe, and had, it had been seen to have happened at different points where somebody was walking along or running along and suddenly they're there and then this rock opened up and ate them. And I want to say they talk about stepping on it, so it can't be that big.
Yeah, first I was thinking that, okay, I hate to be so contrite as to use the terminology, but cloaking, if there was a opening or something that was cloaked, you'd think you'd step there and then you'd immediately fall in like it was a hole or whatever. But yeah, for them, it'd be interesting though if they actually stepped there first and then the rock just went chomp.
Well, I mean, don't go away from the cloaking thing just yet, because there's some bizarre stuff going to happen. And you're going to see shades of things from 411 books and from other people who've reported bizarre events throughout the years. So one of the things that I kept thinking whenever I read this story about the man-eating rock was the boulder fields. If you remember in... David Politis's books, the 411 series, he talks about a lot of the people who disappeared having wandered into boulder fields. And it was from the boulder field that they just never exited. Like they walked around a big boulder or rock and then boom, they were gone. And that seemed to be a common denominator, not in every case, but in a lot of cases. So I'm like, okay, that's interesting that we got this Native American legend predating like the 1760, which was the first white interaction where it could be recorded. And the Native people talking about a rock that ate people, which is a very good description of somebody disappeared. And they talked about this was an angry place because the wind would come from all four sides and meet at the top of the mountain, and it would make the spirits angry. And I've thought about that, and I'm not quite sure how that would work, but I'm not arguing with them. They've probably observed something that made them believe that.
Well, I mean, if you're standing in the middle of a dust devil, for example, I mean, you do have wind going all around you, but not right on you if you're in the eye of it, so.
Right. Maybe. Yeah, I just thought it was really interesting. And people, because we have the Native American story, that's our first disappearing people story. Multiple people, from the sound of it, from the stories, had disappeared. And then, because it was so sparsely populated, there aren't a lot of stories at the very beginning. As people came and people went and nobody looked. You know, it's the nature of the time period. It's the nature of the work. You go and you work in the lumber industry for a season. Man, that was really hard work. I got a few bucks in my pocket. I got a jingle. I'm going down there and see if I can't get a city job. So that coming and going thing didn't lend itself to the rest of this. But there are estimates that between 30 and 40 people have disappeared from the Bennington Triangle. And a lot of them are a lot more recent in vintage. In fact, the rest of the cases I'm going to talk about happened in the 1940s and 50s and upward. So the place had a kind of a reputation. There are stories of a hairy monster, a wild man, later on electronics that would malfunction or compasses that would spin wrong. UFOs, or what we would call lights in the sky. So I would say that would be like UFO type things. And there's just so many different things that are going on there. And there's other things that I'm going to talk about. So we now have this 40 some people, possibly, you know, some estimates run from 10 to 40. And it all depends on how you define things. And I will get into that here in a little bit. But we're going to talk a little bit about the period between 40 and 50, because that period seems to be a concentrated period of time. So there were five cases that are listed as officially the Bennington Triangle disappearing people cases. Okay. But there are other cases that definitely fit that bill. So in 1940, there was a little boy by the name of Melvin Hills. He was 13 years old. He was hiking in the area. He had been hiking in the area off and on since, you know, he was a little child with his father first, and then he had gone on, you know, out to hike. I have to tell you, I grew up in the country, so city people that might think, well, gee, that sounds insane. You turn your kid loose in the woods. My mom did that every day. From the time I was about 7 years old on, she would yell, just stay within, you know, yelling distance, Patty. And I spent my time hopping around all throughout the woods on my own. And so the idea that mom and dad let him go hiking for a couple hours, you know, in October of 1942 doesn't rock my world, because it's a normal thing in the country. What else do you do living in the woods but hang in the woods? So anyhow, he goes out in the woods. He had done this multiple times. He was very good at it. He knew the area extremely well, having been born and grown up and hiked through there with his dad for all those years. And he just went out and never came back. Mm-hmm. Nothing has ever been found of him, ever. He's no bones, no clothes, no stories, no abduction cases, nothing. Just nothing. The other one is a really interesting story. And this is because of how he dies. So we got a guy named Carl Herrick. And Carl and his cousin, Henry, are out in the woods hunting on a kind of a day-long hunting trip. Now, it's November the 8th of 1943, and they're supposed to go off in their separate directions and then come back together and meet and talk. Harry goes out, does his thing, and as he comes back, nothing happens. Carl doesn't show up. So he's like, oh, I don't know what's going on. I haven't heard anything. I'll go back to the camp. He's got to come back there. goes back to the camp, nothing. Now it's getting dark. He's, you know, he goes out and he kind of looks around a little bit, yelling, "Hey, where you at, Carl? Carl, come on, dude," you know, kind of thing. Nothing's happening. So he gets scared and he goes and gets help. And for 3 days, these volunteers, the local sheriff's department, neighbors, friends, family, you know, what have you, they're out there beating the woods looking for Carl. That's important. This is another one of those things you'll hear in the 411 stories. People are found in places where they have already been searched multiple times.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. So third day, Carl's out there looking in like one of the last spots that he knew, Henry's out there looking for Carl in one of the last spots he knew Carl had been in. He's walking along and there laying in an open clearing is his cousin in a place that had been searched multiple times before. Now that's not even the weird part. This is the weird part. Carl had been squeezed to death. His lungs had been punctured by his own broken ribs.
Ooh.
And there were strange tracks. Henry would later describe as the weirdest mutated bear tracks he had ever seen. I don't know what that means. And they were all around the body. When the coroners looked, they couldn't substantiate a bear attack. First of all, there were no bites. There were no rips. There were no tears. He had literally had something wrap its arms around him and crush him to death. So forcefully, it drove his broken lungs through his, or broken ribs through his lungs. I looked and I cannot tell you that I've ever seen a story. I have to tell you now, and I say this, I got a little authority on it because my one son is completely fascinated with bear attack stories. Like there are TV shows about nothing but bear attacks and he watches them. And I was saying to him, "Have you ever heard a story like this?" And he's like, "Nah." And, you know, and I looked and put in bear attacks where people get crushed. And inadvertently, yes, sometimes they will get crushed because the bear will fall on them or something. But it's not those kind of devastating injuries. It's a broken rib here and a dislocated or broken arm there kind of a deal. To this day, nobody has the faintest clue what happened to this guy.
Well, the first thing I thought, you know, I mean, well, the term is a bear hug, you know, wrap your arms around so tightly yeah. you crush. But I don't know how the term bear hug came to be, whether bears will do that or not.
Yeah, I don't know. But anyhow,
genetically through bears?
Possibly. Or, you know, I don't know. But anyway, I just thought it was a fascinating story because, and he didn't say just regular bear prints. He was like, they're really bizarre looking.
That's why I said genetically mutated.
Yeah. So then we're going to move on to a guy by the name of Mitty Rivers, 1945. Now, Mitty is an interesting character because he is 74 years old. And he is hosting a group of four other men who want to go hunting. So Mitty is literally scouting for them at 74. So don't think frail old dude, think seasoned mountain man. And as they're being, he's taking these four fellows out in the mountains. And on the morning of November the 12th, 1945, Rivers, he had his son-in-law with him. And they come to this fork. And Rivers says to his son-in-law, "Here, let's separate. You go this direction and I'll go up this way a little bit. And then we'll come back down and see what's what." Because they wanted to know which path was the best one to take for these paid hunters, right? And so his son-in-law, Joe, goes up the one path, goes a ways, nothing. He's back down, he's waiting for Mitty, no Mitty. So he walks up the path farther than he thinks Mitty would have gone, and no Mitty. Starts calling out for Mitty, no Mitty. The hunters are getting bored and restless, and dude, they're paying for this, so they want some entertainment. So they're like, "Hey, something must have happened to him. Let's go look." So they go look. No Mitty. Then they all decide to go back to the camp, expecting him fully to be sitting there grinning at them because he was that guy. and no Midi. The only thing that was ever found of Midi, and this is bizarre in and of itself, is, again, this is Shades of 411. They would eventually find one bullet, one rifle bullet, sitting on a large rock in the middle of the river, sitting upright as though somebody had placed it there. The argument always is, it must have fallen out of his pocket, which would be great if it was just laying in the water, then I would buy that story. But nobody has a bullet fall out and end up sitting on the flat end on a boulder in the middle of a river. Somebody placed it there. To this day, there is no idea what happened to him. No body has ever been found. So now we're going to move on to our next one. This one, I should tell you, Midi was on something called the Long Trail. That was the path they were on. It's called the Long Trail. That's important because a lot of our disappearances are going to be on or at the edge of the Long Trail, which is exactly what it is. It's a trail going through the woods. And it's the long one, not the short one. Because okay. Like I said, it diverged into two different sections. So now there's this young lady by the name of Paula Jean Weldon. She's 18 years old. She works at Bennington College and is a student there. She works in the cafeteria to kind of help pay her tuition. And on December the 1st of 1946, it was kind of a warm day, about 45, 50 degrees out. And after she gets done with her job, she goes back to her dorm room, talks to her friend who's sharing her room with her. She's a little aggravated about something that happened at the cafeteria, and her friend suggests, it's a nice day, why don't you just go for a hike and kind of blow off steam? In this rural area, that's really one of the few things. They had a lot of trails that you could walk and hike. And so Paula goes, great, all right, I'll do that. And she decides to go find the Long Trail. So she's takes off walking. She has a red jacket on, and so she's pretty visible. In the wintertime, you're looking at grays, browns, a little bit of green. She'd be very visible in a bright red jacket. And along the way, she stops and sees a guy standing there, a guy from town, and he's in his 50s, and she asks him, do you know the way to this particular long trail, part of the long trail? And he's like, oh, yeah, it's like right on the way to my house. You just like follow it down this way and go up this way. And he gives her directions, right? And he's in his car, and she had kind of flagged him down. And he just takes off, pulls up into his driveway, and that's the end of it. She goes on and finds the trail. And how we know she found the trail is that there was an older couple walking the trail who see her in her bright red jacket, and she's like maybe 15, 20 yards ahead of them as they come up the trail. And they're watching her. She kind of turns around. She waves at them, so they see her face. It's the middle of the afternoon, so they got a pretty good view of this girl. And, pretty girl, long dark hair. Red jacket. She had on a pair of gray pants, dress pants, and what have you, and dressed appropriately for the weather at that point in time. And they notice her going up around a turn in the trail, and they're, like I said, it's maybe 10, 15 yards behind her. So they expect to either see her going up the long stretch of trail beyond that or encounter her up that way. And they get up there and she's not there. And they don't see any sign of her. There's nothing in the distance. You can't hear her walking. You can't see her. You can't see any flashes of the bright red jacket. And it's a long straight stretch. She's just gone. Now, her dad is a really, really rich guy. So he's immediately notified that she has disappeared. And he comes up and he's like a hell force swinging through the area. He's paying for private people to go looking. He calls the FBI and they come help, and they he gets the sheriff's department out. In fact, the state police of Vermont are actually created as a response to her not being found.
Wow.
Because his argument is, you know, if we had a proper state police force, that she could have been found. She's never found. Now, there are people who will later on, like if you take each story individually, you can kind of shoot some of them down. And like, she's young, maybe she wandered off, you know, maybe she had a boyfriend and she took off with him. But there's no indication of that. Her roommate didn't tell anybody that. Her parents didn't tell anybody that. Her friends at school didn't say anything like that. There were no love letters. I don't know about today's kids, but whenever kids my age and before, we would doodle the boyfriend's name on our tablet. You know what I'm talking about? Like, there was no indication there was a boyfriend. So that's a, yeah, it could happen, but crows could pick her up and carry her off too. It doesn't mean it's likely kind of thing. Now we're coming to a guy by the name of James Tedford. Now, James is interesting. He's a World War I vet who's now an elderly man. And James has, he was a nice guy. Everybody in town knew him. He had a huge tragedy, not only being a war veteran fighting in a war, but when he come home, his wife's name was Pearl. And this is a story inside of a story. So the whole time he's in the war, Pearl's at home, keeping the home fires burning. She misses him. She talks about him all the time. Bennington area was the place where he lived at, was a really small town type thing. So everybody knew everybody. There were no affairs. The mailman wasn't staying too long, nothing. And whenever the work, like, she wrote him faithfully every week. She spent her time with her mom and dad and her brother and sister. She just kind of waited. And they had bought a little tiny house. And she did everything she could to get the house prepped and ready for when he got home. And finally the time arrives for this to happen. And Pearl is so excited. Like, she's told everybody that she could stop in town, that he was coming home today and she was going to go pick him up. And she stopped at the grocery store to pick up something that she thought would be really great to have for part of his homecoming meal, you know, something she forgot. And that's the last time anybody ever sees Pearl. She goes to the store. She comes home. Poor old James gets home and nobody comes to pick him up. And he's like, that's just crazy. So he calls and gets a ride home. He gets there. Their car's parked in the driveway. Her pocketbook is sitting on a stand in the hallway. And the food still in the grocery bag from the local store is sitting on the table. She's never found. And not only did he have to contend with this awful mystery, but then people are cruel. So then it's all, she ran away with the milkman or whatever. And he never marries and he becomes a very quiet man. So fast forward to now, he's an old gentleman. He's living in the Bennington Soldiers Home in St. Albans. And he goes back home to visit a few days a month. And what he does is he takes the bus from the home to St. Albans. He brings with him little suitcase, and he stays 3 or 4 or 5 days with his family, and then he goes back, spends a few weeks, comes back, spends some time with his family. And he's been doing this for years. And on this particular night, which is the night of December the 1st, 1949, he is on his way back home, or back to the Bennington Soldiers Home. And he's gives his ticket to the bus driver. The bus driver remembers seeing him. He'd seen him multiple times before because it was his route.
Right.
There were 13 other people on the bus. All 13 of those people saw him as well. The last stop prior to the Bennington stop, nobody got off the bus. Nobody got off or on the last couple stops prior. And so when they get to Bennington and the 13 people file off, the bus driver's counting heads and he's, oh man, the old guy fell asleep. So he gets up and he goes back expecting to find him asleep, but he's not there. His little attaché case is there. His coat is there. His hat is there, all folded neatly and stacked up one on top of the other, as though he had done it, you know, just to keep it, you know, on the seat beside him. And he's not there. He goes outside the bus and he sees a couple of the guys on the bus and he goes, "Hey, that old guy that was in the back, did you see him get off?" I'm like, "No, he didn't get off. He probably fell asleep back there. He's old." And one of the guys goes up on the bus and looks around. Sure enough, there's nobody there. So the driver goes, "Well, he wouldn't have left without getting his stuff. I've got his suitcase." So he goes over and he opens the side of the bus. And sure enough, there's the old guy's suitcase. Nobody knows what happened to him. He just simply disappeared off the bus as it pulled into Bennington area.
No missing time from anybody else on the bus, or?
No, nothing like that. Nothing at all that they reported. But we might come into that in a little bit here. So then our last fellow for this time frame, which was the most active, is a guy by the name of Paul Jepson. And Paul is, he's just a little boy. He's 8 years old. His mom works. Now, there's a little bit of discrepancy on this. In some of the accounts, they say she works for a pig farmer. In some of the accounts, they say her and her husband were pig farmers and that they had leased a piece of ground from a family member where they had the pigs living. Any way you shake it out, this is the rest of the story is the same. So Paul's 8 years old. His mom has to go feed the hogs, which means feeding them, putting bedding down, getting them water, doing whatever needs to be done. She's going to take somewhere between half an hour to get this done. So she says to Paul, "Hey, just stay in the truck. I'll be right back." Shouldn't take long. She'd done it multiple times before because you do this every day, you know. And he said, "Okay." Just like multiple times before. And she comes back to the truck about 45 minutes to an hour later, and he's gone. Just gone. So she starts looking for him, thinking, "Oh, he got out of the truck. He got to play, and he's followed a squirrel into the woods," or, you know, something stupid like that. And nothing. Well, panic sets in. So she immediately goes to a relative's house. They call for help, and they got everybody out there. Not only do they have everybody out there, they have bloodhounds out there.
Okay.
So the bloodhounds trace him from the truck site where the truck was parked down the old dirt road out to the main highway and 2 miles down the main highway toward Bennington. That's a lot of walking for an 8 year old.
For 45 minutes?
Yep. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then they just stop right in the middle of the road. That's it. Now, that could be interpreted as somebody picked him up. And that would be the Occam's razor, which is the simplest solution, is often the best one, kind of a thing. And I can't tell you that that didn't happen. I can only tell you that his family did not believe that it happened. The police didn't believe that's what happened. There was no indication of it. Now, interestingly enough, when Mrs. Jepson was asked what her son was wearing, so they knew what they were looking for, he was wearing a red coat, from which comes the legend of "Don't wear red on this mountain. It attracts people and it will get you taken." Interestingly enough, I know we're laughing at it, but interestingly enough, I have read stories about a gentleman who was working in an area, I believe it was in Australia, I believe, where they were told there's native people in this area, and they were told that there were spirits that the native people told them there were spirits in this area that were attracted to bright colors. Don't wear bright colors. Wear like blacks, grays, browns, things like that. And if you wear them, even if you wear them on your undergarments, they will know it and they will come and get you. And the guy thought it was crazy. And he realized that he made a joke about his buddy had on a pair of like multicolored socks. They were all bright colors. And he's like, "Nobody's going to touch me. Come on, dude. Nobody can even see them after I put my boots on." And he disappeared. And he's like, "I can't tell you it's what happened. I can tell you that I will never go back there. And if I did, you better believe I'd be wearing gray all the time." because the native people flat out said these spirits are attracted to Keller. So it reminded me of that story a little bit. Whether that's the case or not, there is the legend of the red clothes. The bright colors, these whatever these spirits are that the natives talked about, maybe are attracted to bright colors.
Be interesting if James Tedford was wearing red when he was on the bus.
Would be. Nobody actually said anything about that, but it would be. Yes. We have one last person. Her name is Frida Langer. She is an experienced hiker. She's 53 years old. She's out hiking with her husband and her cousin Herbert, and her husband goes back to the base camp because he's twisted his knee, and he's like, I'm not going to be able to make this hike after all. There's no way. I would just slow you guys down. So I'll go back and I'll rest my leg and you guys go ahead and finish the hike out. You know, I know, Frida, that you got company, so you're not by yourself. It's going to be okay. I'll just wait. And I'm totally fine with that. My leg hurts. I'll just sit there and rest. So they keep going. And then according to Herbert's story, Frida fell in the water when they were crossing a creek. She got all wet. It's October, late October, so it's chilly. And she says to him, hey, I'm only about a half hour away from base camp. Why don't you let me run back down and get clean, dry clothes on? I know it'll take a little while. Take a break. I'll be right back. And he's like, sure. Not a problem. So he's sitting there waiting. And after an hour and a half, 2 hours, 2.5 hours, he gets a little pissy. And then he decides to go back and he's mad. And he's like, gets in there and he's like yelling at her husband, like, where's Frida? She made me into a fool. I thought she was coming back. And he's like, she's with you, right? He's like, no. And he tells the story that she had, you know, gone to change her clothes. They never found her. Well, they didn't find her body. And so there were people looking for her, the National Guard, the Coast Guard, the Army. They all went through here and they're looking for her. Like they're at this, the local police, volunteers, they are scouring everything. And they're doing it like militarily. They have people in charge that are doing, you know, the, you will walk 10 feet apart and, you know, look at your area, the whole nine yards. It wasn't a just haphazard 30 people running through the woods type deal. And they didn't find anything of her. Now, interestingly enough, hers is the only body that will ever be found. She was found 3.5 miles from her campsite on May the 12th of 1951, and she was so decomposed that they couldn't tell cause of death. But here's the interesting thing. She was laying in the open in a spot that was signed off on as having been looked at by the Coast Guard and the Army that volunteered from the local Army base in that area as well. So they all looked for her in that area. And they would have had to have walked over her and not seen her. So it's interesting. So let's talk a little bit about what all is going on in the Bennington Triangle, because it might have a lot to do with what happened to these people. In fact, I think it probably does have a lot to do. So there are all these bizarre stories. So the first story is about this Bigfoot-like creature. And in the early 1800s, there's a story about, they call him the Bennington Monster. There's, the story goes that there was this poach that was carrying people, and they got mired down in a horrible mucky rainstorm with, you know, the roads were just dirt, and they needed to take an alternative route to try to get to some place where there was dry, they were dry and safe for the rest of the night. So the driver decides to take the side road that he's hoping will, it's less of a slog for the horses and what have you. Not as well traveled, but not as difficult to pull the carriage through because it's more flat. And as they're going, you know, it's the end of the day. It's still daylight. And he starts to notice along the road in the mud, these large footprints. And he slows down the carriage. He's like, what the heck is that? So he pulls it to a stop and he gets out and he looks at him. A couple of the guys get out of the thing and they're looking at him and they're like, what the heck is that? It looks like human footprints, only a lot larger and kind of warped. Now, part of that could be the mud. I don't know. So they get back into the carriage, and just about as they're climbing in, this thing comes out of the woods, spooks the horses, attacks and flips the carriage over. The people fall out. They're scrambling for safety, and they all end up climbing through the woods to get to help and tell the same story about this creature with glowing eyes that roared after it, as it was attacking the carriage and trying to tear it apart. And then it stopped, looked at them, and took off back into the woods. So at least from the estimates are 6 to 7 people saw it. But it's been seen many times since then. It's always described as having, as being large, 6+ feet tall, with black fur, upright, long arms. And they say it looks a lot like a Sasquatch, but not exactly. Now we're going to come into something else that comes into play for folks. There are people who report walking the trails in the Bennington Triangle area, and they talk about these bizarre moments of suddenly being confused and disoriented, or and sitting down, feeling like they couldn't walk any further, and they just sit down under a tree or against a log, you know, something like that, and they get this almost drugged feeling. And everything's moving, it's nothing makes sense. So they have this drugged feeling and they don't know what to make of it. Some of them are smart enough to get up and keep moving anyway, headed in the direction of help. Some of them are not. Some of them are actually so lightheaded, confused, disoriented that whenever people find them and rescue them, they're still struggling with it. And there are some who report mysteriously traveling elsewhere. And I mean, like, to other parts of the forest. I'm not talking to other planets or dimensions, but they don't know how it happened. And we're going to visit a few of those stories on the way. Now, another one of the things that we had, you know, we'd already talked about the rocks that eat people and what have you, and the Abenaki who say that it's cursed and all of that. They continue to tell these stories even till today. So that's something. In 1937, the town of Glastonbury was actually disincorporated. So it's now just an old abandoned site. If you go up there, you can actually find it. Now the buildings, all the wooden part of the buildings have rotted away, but the stone structures, basements, things like that all still exist. And
don't when wear people, red. Yeah.
Huh?
Don't yeah. wear red. Yeah.
Don't wear red. Now people think, you know, they have a lot of stories about things. Another one of the things you hear stories about are weather patterns, bizarre weather patterns. Like, for example, it was a beautiful sunny day. It was about 65 degrees. And I stepped into the forest and all of a sudden I noticed it was suddenly very chilly and it was gray. And the further I went back into the forest, the more gray it got. And I thought, oh my gosh, it's going to rain. And by the time I turned around to go back out, it had to be no more than like 30 degrees. I don't understand what happened, but it was very disconcerting. The next thing they'll usually say is, and I noticed once I walked into the woods that there were no sounds. There were no birds. There were no bugs. There was no wind sighing through the trees, but the trees were moving. And it got really creepy. And there was like this air about it that I needed to run. Something was looking at me. Something was watching me. Something was stalking me. So those are some of the things you hear a lot in a lot of the stories. And we're going to talk about some specific ones. There have been lights reported over top of Bennington Triangle for literally 200 years. And so if Bigfoot and UFOs are a more modern construct, this one kind of throws it out. There have been strings of lights seen across the sky. There have been ones that have been described as silos floating through the air. There's just been so many of those kind of stories, and we're going to visit a couple of them on our way out the door. And now the most reasonable stories, there is this bizarre story in 1867 of this alleged wild man sighting. And he was a man who apparently went feral. He wore a large black coat of animal fur. And frankly, he was a little bit of a creeper because he was known to expose himself to unsuspecting women walking on the trails.
Yeah.
He was also said to have a revolver that he would use to intimidate people, but eventually he was run out of the area. He might have been the guy that we talked about at the beginning, who was the murderer who escaped from the insane asylum.
Okay.
There is some supposition he might be that guy. Time frame wise, he would have been old, but he might have been that guy. Now, the next thing we have are, you know, animal predation, which is a very realistic thing, except for one thing. So if it was cougars, mountain lions, bobcat, lynx, even bear, you should see signs. There should be blood. There should be ripped up clothing. There should be things that tell you this was an animal got them. You know, and we have modern correlations. We know that there's stories in Southern California of people hiking and, you know, up an isolated trail and getting attacked by a mountain lion or whatever. And there's definitely signs. There's a lot of blood. There's the scuffling and, you know, trying to fight it off and what have you, ripped up clothing. There's things to show you this was animal deprivation. And this not, there's not a single report of that in any of this. So even though I want to make sure that that's said, I honestly don't believe that's our answer. And the reason I don't believe that's our answer is because I can't believe that every time somebody went to missing, that they all went up there, sheriff's departments, police departments, military, you know, things like that. And not one of them in any of the reports said, hey, this was animals. We think it was a mountain lion. This is why. You know, I can't believe that that wasn't even thought of. And it wasn't looked for. And then if that would have been there, you would have thought that would have made it into the police report. Not, we cannot find any sign of her. To cover that territory, I wanted to make sure we talked a little bit about that. We're kind of coming to our end now. So in 2009, there was a gentleman by the name of Joseph Citro, who was a writer. And he's the one who coined the term, the Bennington Triangle. He was a folklorist and he collected a lot of this, of these stories. And he began to talk about what all was going on up there in the Bennington area. The other thing that I thought was interesting is he started talking about something called the Arcane Stone Cairns. Now, for those who don't know what a cairn is, it is a grouping of rocks that kind of make up, not a pyramid, a rough pyramid shape, kind of a pile. And they are being found and have been found for a long, long time in that area. Now, the farmers would build them a long time ago when they were clearing pastures. They would put them in piles and then they would use off of them to make fences and, you know, supports for their barns and what have you. But the cairns are high in high elevation where nobody's farming. These are located miles away from any trails or any roads, way back in the middle of nowhere. And nobody has the faintest idea where they came from, how long they've been there, or what their purpose ever was. So he started out with talking about the cairns. It quickly got to the other stories. He started doing some research and he quickly came to the other. So I wanna share some stories on our way out. There's a book called Haunted Hikes of Vermont by author Tim Simard. I hope I pronounced your names right, sir. And he tells us a really interesting story about Columbus Day, 2008. There were two hikers on Long Trail. That's that trail I told you everybody's having issues with. And they come across this young guy named Dave. Dave helped rebuild the fire towers along that trail. And they start up a conversation and Dave, you know, they start talking to Dave. Hey, you know, if you've been up here, if you know, I've heard these really weird stories. You know, you got any stories? You see a Bigfoot up here or a thing, man? And Dave kind of gets really quiet and he says, I've been up here for quite a while. I've rebuilt several of the towers. And yeah, this place is really creepy, but not like you mean. I've not seen any of that stuff. So what he tells them is that there's a shelter up there called Goddard Shelter. So there's shelters in a lot of the trails along the Appalachian Trail as well. A lot of places they'll put these little buildings that are shelters where hikers, campers can get out of the weather or take shelter if something would happen. So this is, and they are also used by the staff in these state parks and what have you as shelter if they're working. So he tells them that he was staying at Goddard's shelter with some of his friends who also worked for the same and doing the same stuff. And while he was on Long Trail working, he said, my friends would tell me that I would sit up in the middle of the night. I'd still be asleep and I'd be laughing uncontrollably. And other nights, I would wake up screaming as if I was in terror. And he said, I don't remember anything about any of it. And he said, my friends were so concerned about what was going on and how disturbing it was that they urged him to stop working in this area, to get out. They had stayed with him in other sites, on other places, doing the same work. They had never seen him act like this before. And he's like, I don't know what that is, but it convinced me and my friends that there's something here that's influencing people. There's another book, Ghost Towns of New England, and the author is Fressenden S. Blanchard. I apologize, Mr. Blanchard, if I got it wrong. But he tells this story about two men who went fishing on Peter's Branch, which is one of the streams. And one went upstream, one went downstream. And they were going to just sit there and fish and come back to the center and like make lunch and what have you. Well, when the time came for them to get back together, the one guy comes down and he's waiting and he's like, diddle bopping, dum dum dum, come on dude, come on. And he can't find his friend, so he goes downstream and he's looking and he's like, there's nothing there. I mean, there's nothing. His tackle, his stuff is all gone. There's nothing. He's not back at the car. Nothing. A short time after all this has happened and the police have gone out and they've looked and what have you, somebody's walking along that same general area right there where the guy disappeared. And this is what's interesting. Near the brook where the man disappeared, on the stump of a tree, they found a human skull sitting as if it was watching down the trail. Now, me personally, I'd be thinking crazy people. You know, that would be my first thought, not panthers. But the local authority said that a panther placed it there.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Not buying it.
Again, not my first choice.
If that's your choice instead of inspiring panic and loss of tourism in an area, you might say panthers too.
You might, but I mean, anybody with common sense would know better. Panthers don't just carry, you know, skulls with no meat on them and sit them on trees, aim down the middle of a path where the guy actually disappeared.
That is so bizarre.
Isn't it? Bigfoots might.
Yeah, but to completely strip a skull of all the tissue, and I'm assuming that's what you're when you say a skull,
said,
I mean, usually that implies just
skull.
The bone part. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's what they said. So in 1970, there were two little boys. They're 10 years old. They were in town with their family, and it was a kid and his buddy, and they start. The family's looking, doing some grocery shopping and stuff, which is absolutely something that a 10-year-old child does not want to have to drag his friends through. So they get permission to go walking two blocks down the street to this open field. And that's what they do. According to the boys, they walk down toward the field and they see a metallic disc hovering 10 feet above the ground, about 40 feet away from them at the edge of the woods. The children are scared to death. And the one boy's just standing there, panicky. The other one's screaming, let's run, let's run, let's run. And he can't get this kid to react to him at all. It's like this kid's frozen in stone. So he turns around and he runs to get the kid's parents. He needs help because he can't physically drag him away. So he goes and he tells them and they come running. You know, they're not sure what's going on, but they definitely get frightened. And so they start running. They get to the spot. And he's not there. However, he does step out of the woods a little bit later. And he later tells them that the craft, he doesn't say the people, he says the beings, he says the craft, began to spin and got closer, and that he got a telepathic exchange. Like he said, somebody talked to him in his head. That's a telepathic exchange. And then it flew away at great speed. And afterward, the boy began to have psychic abilities. He started passing this message about the overall intent of these beings is to watch the planet. This is the standard stuff you would hear in the 70s, you know. The aliens and others like them are preparing us people to be ready and receptive. This is his exact words. Receptive to be able to trust the benevolence of these beings that have become constrained by the requirements of the military security that surrounds the alien phenomena. That is not a 10-year-old boy's language.
Not usually. Yeah. Although yeah, I knew a kid when I was 10 that, you know, a good friend of mine, I won't mention him by name, who had extraordinary intelligence. I could expect that from him. Yeah.
Okay. But, you know, like I said, it's not just normally you don't expect that out of a kid. Mm-hmm. So the next one, we're down right to the very end now, is a gentleman by the name of Ray Dufresne, who in 2003 was driving along Gastonbury Mountain when he looks up on the mountainside and he sees what he describes as a large, hairy, black, hairy, bipedal creature with very long arms, almost to its knees. And he pulls the car over and he's watching this thing climbing up through the mountainside there until it eventually disappears into the woods. And he was so shaken by what he saw, he reported it. Now, that's 2003. That's not a lifetime ago for most of us. At least
not dogs smart, not smartphone lifetime, but you know,
So then there's a gentleman by the name of Robert Singley, who has made his mark on Bennington Triangle stories. In 2008, on a Sunday night, he went for a hike. The Sunday afternoon, he went for a hike. Now he worked as a teacher and he was also a student at the Bennington College of Music, and he was working on a project. And he decided that he was an experienced hiker. He loved to hike. It's one of the things he enjoyed. And he was working on a project that was just kind of like eluding him. So he decided to go for a long hike and just kind of get away from everything for a while. And he'd come back to it. Now, his story is really fascinating to me because this is what he would later say. Right before I lost the trail, before he got lost, everything crescendoed into a weird sort of dizzying confusion. It just suddenly got dark. And then I was like, where am I? What is going on? I was totally lost. And that's when a fog rolled in and it started getting dark. He said he was wearing his heavy boots, long shorts, a long sleeve shirt, a wool sweater, a rain slicker, a winter hat and mittens. I never understood people who wear shorts with all the cold weather clothes. Mm. But anyway, it suddenly became a cold, rainy night. He pulled his headlight out of the pack, which is the only thing he brought. For some bizarre reason, this guy who's an experienced hiker doesn't bring a compass, doesn't bring any GPS, doesn't bring a map, doesn't bring anything but a headlight. But he pulls it out and suddenly it's broken, so he can't use it. It was fine when he put it in the pack. He didn't fall or stumble in any way to break it, but it's suddenly broken. And he doesn't know how it got broken. So the night becomes eerily quiet, he says, and then he realizes he has to stay put and wait for daylight. You know, that's the first rule. Don't keep wandering around. Just sit down and wait. Somebody will find you. You die when you start wandering around because then they can't locate you. In the morning, he puts in a pretty cold, miserable, scary night. But in the morning, he walks 3 to 4 miles to Goddard's shelter. But he says that he couldn't understand how he got there. He couldn't understand how he could be that close to Goddard's shelter. He had only been a quarter mile from his car when he had suddenly started feeling that confusion and dizziness and what have you. So it was between, his car was between where he lost the trail and Goddard's shelter, but his car wasn't where he left it. At least he didn't think it was where he left it. He should have passed it, pulled off the road on the way to Goddard's shelter. He would be found because other people realized he was missing. So they had called the police and what have you. So there would be people come to rescue him as he's wandering down past Goddard's shelter and realizes, oh my gosh, this is Goddard's shelter. I've gone way too far. I can't even understand where's my car? When he gets settled and the police get him calmed down and everything, he tells them
where he started and where they found him. He had walked 7 miles from where he lost the trail. He was on the other side of the mountain from where he should have been, and he can't explain any of it. All he remembered was getting lost, sitting down and thinking, no, this is the way you die. You keep walking around. You have to sit down and wait for them to come and get you. And he said in a quote during an interview, I still think that I was sucked through a time continuum or something. Completely confused. Again, 411. People are found many miles from where, they were last seen. And this is my last one. So there was a young YouTuber, my young in his mid-20s, and he decided to go into the Bennington Triangle and do a kind of like a video about it, telling the stories and what have you, spending the night, a couple nights in the triangle, see what happens to me, kind of a bravado. Only thing is the bravado kind of goes away. And I actually watched the entire video of what he shot. So the first thing he notices, which he didn't notice when he was there, he said he only noticed it later on when he was editing, is there were no birds. There were no animal sounds, though. From the moment he steps into the, like he's out along the road and there's sunshine. Now, I grant you, you're going into the tree line, so it's going to be more muted, but the sun shouldn't go away completely. You should still see dapples of it through the tree. I've been in the woods 1,000 times. Mm-hmm. But the sun went away. It got very gray. It got very quiet. No birds, no bugs. No, anything, you could just hear a little bit of wind. And he puts in a pretty unpleasant night. He feels very uncomfortable. He talks about a strange energy. He's like, maybe I'm psyching myself out. I don't know, but it's just weird. And by morning, he's decided he's not spending any more time. Interestingly enough, once he gets in there, he's talking to somebody who says to him, dude, why do you have a red jacket on? And he goes, what do you mean? Why do I have a red jacket on? And he's like, you obviously didn't do your homework. And he tells him the story. And then he's like, oh, my gosh, that just psyched me out even more. And so I'm going to give half of the story over to he was just psyched out. But this is the part of the story that's really interesting. So he makes it through his first night there, very uncomfortable, very cold, very miserable, very frightened. He doesn't really sleep. In the morning, he decides that he's so full of fear and anxiety, he doesn't know why, he can't explain it, but he's just going to leave. In fact, his quote is, I am so scared, I feel like I could cry. So that's pretty anxious. Mm-hmm. So he's walking along out, he's talking to the camera, doing his shtick as a YouTuber, and he's saying, I'm almost out of the woods now, everything's, and then you hear this really loud sound. It's somewhere between a giant growl or purr and a huge boulder crashing and rolling. It's loud. It's like, which could have been both things. It could have been something growling and something throwing.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, he's really terrified. You can see in the video, he's like, oh my gosh, what was that? And he's looking around, and again, some of it could be hype. I'm not saying it's not, but as he's coming out of there, he looks like he's ready to cry. He's either a really, really good actor or something really spooked this kid. And as he gets out of there, he says, there's something watching me. It was almost that feel of like he's giving you the impression, he didn't say the words, but he gave you the impression he felt like he was the prey. And, he gets your hackles up and you just know something's wrong.
Right.
And he's like panicking and he's like, I got to get out of here. Oh, my gosh, there's something watching me. And he said afterwards, he gets calmed down. He gets back to his car and he's like, I felt like there were things watching me. And then he says later on in the thing at the very end, he puts like a little printout above the picture and he says, for hours afterward, I still felt like I was being watched as though whatever was following me through the woods somehow managed to follow me when I got home. And with that, I have to end my stories for tonight for the Bennington Triangle. But it is a fascinating compendium of paranormal activity. And I absolutely don't think we've visited it for the last time because there are more tales to tell. But I just wanted to share this because it's not a well-known site. It's one of many sites across the world. I mean, people think about the Bermuda Triangle as singular, and then you got the Alaska Triangle, and then you got, you know, there's so many of them, but there are a lot more of these places than you could possibly imagine. Wrong way places where things happen that shouldn't. And with that, I wish you all a good night. And I guess, Stu, I've kept you out of the woods again.